This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If they're this crazy, how are they still here?
There's nothing stopping this party now because all the enforcement mechanisms inside the Democrat Party are pulling the party to the left.
When I turn on cable or sometimes look online, you see these people that call themselves pundits that have never worked in a campaign or done anything.
In public, you know, would present this sober sort of pseudoscientific persona. He has a gift of the gab, obviously.
You know what's really crazy? I was having this conversation with my sons over the weekend, and we were talking about politics. They're both kind of into it. One of them's really into it, but because of what I do, and I'm always talking about the news and things like that at the house, we have conversations about world affairs, politics, things like that. So I'm talking to him over the weekend, and we're talking about Republicans and Democrats. And of course, as you know, I have complaints about both, right? But you know where I stand. I vote Republican because Democrats are basically the spawn of Satan now. And along those lines, they asked, one of them asked, have they always been like this? And his thinking was, just a little background on it, was how could a political party that supports open borders, tranny madness, I mean, you name the evil, sick thing, how could a political party like that have a long foothold on, you know, half of the country's body politic? We have two major political parties, half of them think that way. And that was his thinking, was if they're this crazy, how are they still here? And I got to talking to him about it, and I got to thinking about it. This is recent. Now, for them, you know, they're both under 20. For them, it's all they've ever known. But for me, probably you, depending on how old you are, I'm 45. I've never been a Democrat. I've never cheered for Democrats. But, you know, open borders. This is Bill Clinton in 1995.
All Americans, not only in the states most heavily affected, but in every place in this country, are rightly disturbed by the large numbers of illegal aliens entering our country. The jobs they hold might otherwise be held by citizens or legal immigrants. The public service they use impose burdens on our taxpayers. That's why our administration has moved aggressively to secure our borders more by hiring a record number of new border guards, by deporting twice as many criminal aliens as ever before, by cracking down on illegal hiring, by barring welfare benefits to illegal aliens. In the budget I will present to you, we will try to do more to speed the deportation of illegal aliens who are arrested for crimes, to better identify illegal aliens in the workplace, as recommended by the commission headed by former Congresswoman Barbara Jordan. We are a nation of immigrants, but we are also a nation of laws. It is wrong and ultimately self-defeating for a nation of immigrants to permit the kind of abuse of our immigration laws we have seen in recent years, and we must do more to stop it.
That was not ancient history. I watched Bill Clinton give that speech as a young man. That was 1995. And if that's the first time you saw that, or maybe you forgot about it, sounds like a Republican today, right? 1995. So what happened? Well, America made a disastrous choice, an absolutely disastrous choice. Dissatisfaction with George Bush and the Republican Party led to America choosing a man who wanted to seriously change it. What did he say? Fundamentally change it. Here's Barack Obama, again, talking about illegal immigration. And he almost sounds like a hardliner on it. But if you actually listen here, what's he doing? He's shoehorning in what the new Democrat Party is going to stand for. Here it was.
The American people are a welcoming and generous people. those who enter our country legally and those who employ them disrespect the rule of law. And because we live in an age where terrorists are challenging our borders, we cannot allow people to pour into the U.S. undetected, undocumented, and unchecked. Americans are right to demand better border security and better enforcement of the immigration laws. Illegal immigration is bad for illegal immigrants and bad for the workers they compete against. Replacing the flood of illegals with a regulated stream of legal immigrants who enter the United States after background checks and who are provided labor rights would enhance our security, raise wages, and improve working conditions for all Americans.
You hear what he did at the end? It was the end that was the tell. That was the giveaway. Oh, we need to crack down on these illegals, and can't be hiring these illegals. But hey, you know what we need? We need a lot of foreigners. We have to do it the legal way. The right way, you see. We'll just do it legally. And that was then. Today, as the Democrat Party has continued to just lose its ever-loving mind, today, well, here's the most powerful Democrat in Washington, D.C.
The only way we're going to have a great future in America is if we welcome and embrace immigrants, the Dreamers, and all of them, because our ultimate goal is to help the Dreamers, but get a path to citizenship for all 11 million or however many undocumented there are here.
The brakes, they're off. The brake lines have been cut. There are no more guardrails. There's nothing stopping this party now, because all the enforcement mechanisms inside the Democrat Party are pulling the party to the left. There are no more prominent, powerful voices in the Democrat Party saying, stop, slow down, that's too far. They're just not. I mean, the Democrat nominee for Senate in the state of Texas, now, if you are a Democrat and you want to get elected in a statewide race in Texas, you have to be the most right-wing Democrat in the country. You have to be cowboy hat it up, God and country, that you have to be that guy. Instead, Bottom is their candidate.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I always think of myself as a Christian who hates Christianity,
yep.
Right?
I know personally that I've learned as much about my faith from Salman's tradition, from the Islamic mystics, from poets like Rumi, as much as I have from Christian authors and Christian writers.
This is where they are. And these new DSA types, the Democrat Socialists of America, you know, a bunch of people on our side, maybe you looking at them right now saying, well, these are radicals, these are crazy, this is too far. I'm here to tell you right now, as sad and scary as this may be, these positions are not too far. They are the positions of the Democrat Party 5 years from now.
So we're going to put up on the screen a few of the things that are part of your platform. And I want to ask you, just give me sort of a true or false on these. Abolish the Senate.
True.
Okay. Replace the presidency and Supreme Court as we now know them. Abolish ICE.
Absolutely.
Abolish borders and give amnesty to anyone currently in the U.S. illegally.
As a long-term plan, yep.
Defund the Pentagon.
Absolutely.
Abolish prisons, at least in large part.
Yeah, again, that is part of a long-term program, yeah.
Okay, so no prisons. Government or public ownership of most large corporations.
Yeah.
That's too far. I just showed you the progression from 1995 to now. That's the future. That's what we're up against. That's why we have to keep winning elections. All right? We have an enormous show. We have to talk to Sean Spicer. And as you probably already guessed, Jeffrey Tucker is losing his mind about all these Fauci emails that we now have, courtesy of Senator Rand Paul. So we're going to get to all that in a moment. Before we get to that, I want to get to this with you. Your mortgage. Do you have one? Now, do you have high interest debt with that mortgage? I know it sucks. I know. You're carrying 20, 30% interest on something. When you carry that kind of interest on something, it's very difficult to even make the minimum payments, right? To just cover the interest. So you never feel like you're chopping away at the principal because you're not. And then you convince yourself that, well, this is going to be forever. This is going to last forever. I'll never be free of this. And that's not true. American financing has been getting people just like you out of this bind for a long time. If you have high interest debt and you have a mortgage, you need to go to AmericanFinancing.net/Jesse and find out what they can do for you. All right? We'll be back. Less than 100 days away from the midterms. Isn't that freaky when you think about that? Less than 100 days. And obviously, you know how it works. We talk about it all the time. Political wisdom says it's probably not going to go our way, right? Is it going to be a bloodbath? I don't know. Are we going to maybe fare pretty well? Redistricting helped. I don't know. I bet Sean knows a lot of this stuff, though. Joining me now, Sean Spicer, host of the Sean Spicer Show. All right, Sean, help me prepare for the midterms. Should I start preemptively crying now? Should I buy some party poppers? What's coming?
Well, I'm not going to decide what you buy or don't buy, Jesse. That's up to your personal preference there. What I will tell you is, and I love the way you frame this, because when I turn on cable or sometimes look online, you see these people that call themselves pundits that have never worked in a campaign or done anything. So let me kind of lay this out for you real quick. I don't know who's going to win or not. You're 99 days out today. There's a lot of X factors. The political environment is not fantastic for the party in power. But let me just lay this out for you if you're a betting person. There are three reasons that Republicans could keep the majority in the House. Number one is redistricting. You noted this a minute ago, but there's about a 10 to 12 seat advantage that Republicans have going into the midterms. So imagine you're starting a baseball game or a football game and you have 10 to 12 points ahead of the other person. Not a bad place to start. That's number one. Number two, money. The DNC is literally $2 million in the hole. They put up their headquarters as collateral the other day. The RNC is sitting at about $120 million and the Trump super PACs combined have over $400 million. Money matters. The Supreme Court just ruled a week ago that they can coordinate between the federal committees, the RNC, the NRSC, the NRCC, et cetera, with the campaigns. They blew away the caps. This is going to be huge. So that money, it's actually goes a lot further now. And then the third thing is that the Dems are in absolute disarray. They are getting pulled far, far to the left by these Democratic Socialist candidates. And there's a lot of infighting. What that all means to me is, does it mean the Republicans are going to keep the House? Not necessarily, but let me give you the math, because this is what matters. Cook Political Report just did an analysis of all 435 seats. You need 218 to win. And Cook, and I'm not trying to sound like a wise guy here, but I said this 4 weeks ago. Cook came out with the exact same analysis. Right now, today, they have Republicans at 212, Democrats at 207. 18 as toss-ups. Now, do the math on that. If you're a Republican right now, there's 18 toss-up seats. You're at 212. You need six to win the majority. Those aren't bad odds, right? They have to go 33%. Democrats, on the other hand, who all of the media loves to say is got the advantage going in this election, actually have to win two-thirds, 66% of those toss-up seats to take the majority. In the Senate, the math is even worse for Democrats. According to Cook, that came out just the other day, there are four, count them, one, two, three, four pure toss-up seats. Democrats need to run the table, take all four in order to take a majority in the Senate. Those four that they consider toss-ups include Alaska, which is a strong Republican hold, and Ohio, a strong Republican hold. Does that mean they won't be competitive? No, but it means they need to run the table in every single one of those seats to have a shot at taking the majority. The numbers just aren't there for Democrats if you're actually trying to look at this in a data-driven way.
All right, let's focus on some data, or maybe get a little bit beyond the data, Sean. How do we measure motivation? Because you look at these special elections, and they have not gone our way. And it's because, you know, yeah, we're the party in power, the party out of power wants to crawl across a mile of broken glass to go vote, and the other one's kind of happy right now. I'm worried about us being fat and happy at the midterms and the other side being rabid dogs.
You're absolutely right to focus on this. your analysis, though, I'm not worried about us being fat and happy. I'm worried about us being pissed off. Our base isn't excited. Sometimes you're right. When you're really when you're fat and happy, you don't get motivated to vote. I think we're quite the opposite. We're depressed. People aren't excited. They look at the SAVE Act and say you've got a majority in the House and Senate, and all we've heard is a bunch of excuses. There was a poll that came out just yesterday from Politico that said no one knows what the heck's in the big, beautiful bill. I got to be honest with you. I don't find that surprising. These guys have done a horrible job selling the tenets of the bill. When the average person, when they filed their tax return last year, Jesse, had an average increase of $1,100 in their return, and they had no idea why, because Republicans suck at actually communicating the agenda that they've passed that's made people's lives better. So I agree with you that this is something I'd keep an eye on. The X factor is, are people motivated? Are they excited about the election? And the Democrats right now are willing to walk through that glass that you talked about, and Republicans are like, what's on Twitter?
Okay, let me ask this question in about the most delicate way that I'm able to ask it, Sean. Iran, when it comes to Iran, I'm not going to go into the decision to go and all that. That's not my point of all this. My point is, if we are still going to be there in November, and honestly, I think the chances are probably pretty strong the way it looks right now. And if we get a spike in gas prices, which is not at all unreasonable, it's already starting to tick up a little bit, I worry that bloodbath may come at us. Is that a weird worry?
No, because two things. One, elections are about me and you. How are you, the elected official, making my life better? That's why you hire someone in public office, to keep you safer, to make you more prosperous, to make the world a better place, if you will. And if all they see on their headlines is another country, and I get it. Just to be clear, I get what President Trump's doing to keep us safer, but I don't know that it translates like that. And so if all you see on television is that the price of gas is going up and we're fighting a war somewhere across the world somewhere that I can't personally understand why, which also comes down to the messaging, that is a problem. And the fact is that the polls do show a lack of enthusiasm, not just among low propensity voters, but even among those high propensity voters, the people who vote 3 out of 4, 4 out of 4 elections that were so critical to the Trump coalition in 2024, are not as motivated as they should be. And that is a problem that's sending shockwaves through the political establishment.
John, I know you're not going to trash the man, because I know you know him and you work for him. I'm not asking for that. I'm not trashing him either, but we saw 15 days to slow the spread. We got the Fauci files today. That was Trump's decision. He obviously tried to reverse it. By then, it was out of control, and they ruined the great economy he had built. Disastrous decision, no question about it. The decision to go to Iran, when, I mean, deportations were up, and he was making some deals, and things were churning along. Does Donald Trump have self-destructive tendencies?
No. Interesting take. No. Not at all. In fact, I thought you're going somewhere else on that, which is, I think sometimes people give him bad advice. And I do believe that he went into Iran for the right reasons. The where I sort of question some of the advice that he may have gotten, and I don't know this for certain by any means, is I do wonder if people tried to sell him on how quickly it would be resolved in the wake of a very decisive victory in Venezuela. And I get the sense that they said, this is the right thing to do to prevent them from having a weapon of mass destruction and continue to threat the United States, but that it would be a lot easier to complete that task. I do believe that's very possible. And same thing happened in COVID, frankly, where, as you know, you just noted this, there was this feeling that we now know was a lie that was, hey, we've got this disaster. All we need to do is take 15 days, everybody chills out for a little bit, and the world would be great. And we now know that, just like, you know, the 6 feet, that was Anthony Fauci making crap up. But the president definitely trusted people that he probably shouldn't have.
Yeah. Well, we clearly see from the email files, to his credit, he realized that pretty early on when he was chewing out Fauci and Burks up and down. All right, Sean, sorry, I'm out of time. We'll do this. I'm sure we're going to do this a lot over the next 100 days. I'll see you, buddy. All right. Speaking of Fauci, speaking of those emails, as you can imagine, Jeffrey Tucker has been poring over them all weekend long, and we're going to talk to him in a moment about what stood out to him. Let me talk to you about your cell phone, though, your wireless plan. For one, you know you're paying way too much. And you know why, by the way? You know that big wireless company you use? They have a store on every street corner, don't they? Who's paying for that? You are. How is it that Pure Talk, they can offer the same network? They're on the exact same network, same satellites, but they don't charge you the same amount? How is that possible? Pure Talk isn't making you pay for a brick and mortar store on every corner of every city in the United States of America. Just great coverage, great people, veteran-led company, and you'll pay a fraction of the cost of the big guys. Go to puretalk.com/JesseTV. We'll be back. Well, I am unreasonably excited today, and although I'm an incredibly selfish person, I have to tell you, I'm not excited for me. I'm excited for my friend Jeffrey Tucker, because Rand Paul got these emails of Fauci released, making Fauci look like exactly what he is, the biggest lying hack slave loser in the world. And this has to be Jeffrey Tucker's Super Bowl. It really does. You know what? I'm just going to hand him the show now. Joining me, president of the Brownstone Institute, Jeffrey Tucker. Jeffrey, congratulations to you, sir. Congratulations. What?
It's funny you put it that way. I really do feel that way. I had big plans this weekend. The beach. Surfing, you know, I don't know, but I canceled them all so I could read the Fauci diaries. You know, that it's more than 1,000 pages. And I have to warn you, I'm only about 40% the way in it. I've been doing nothing but reading for 3 days. But I'm reading it so closely because it's so tremendously revealing. Crucially, nobody in the national press expected this to happen. We know that Rand had been sitting on a lot of material for a long time, but we didn't know exactly when it was going to be released. Well, here's the full diaries that Fauci kept from, we have them from January until January 2020, until his retirement. And I'm just following along day by day. I practically has the trajectory of time memorized in my own mind. I mean, I feel like I keep living it over and over and over again. Well, now I get to live it through Fauci's own words, in what looks to me like a sort of first draft of an autobiography. And it's tremendously fascinating.
All right, Jeffrey, I don't even know how to ask this question, so I'm just going to throw it out in the lamest, hackiest way possible. After 40% of the diary, what parts just jumped out at you the most? Because I've got so many highlights going through my head, I don't even know where to begin. Yeah. What parts made you wince?
Well, I don't know where to begin either, but I will tell you that I think one way to read them is to understand that Fauci wrote everything that Fauci did and wrote during these 2 years under consideration here were designed to create a sort of misdirection, deflection, to valorize himself, provoke a kind of hagiographic understanding of who he is and his role, give him a halo in order to protect him against what he worried about mostly, which was being exposed for his role in gain-of-function research that unleashed a global pandemic for which he feared being personally blamed. If you understand that, then you get his manipulations of the media, the frenzied interviews, 3, 6, 9, 12, 18 a day, the demand that he be interviewed more, the fights with the White House press office because they got sick of him being interviewed all the time, the way he would sort of surreptitiously develop tight relationships with powerful reporters, say things on background that were nasty about Trump, making it clear that he was a partisan against Trump, that everything he was doing was designed to drive him from office. But then in public, you know, would present this sober sort of pseudoscientific persona. He has a gift of the gab, obviously. So there was a kind of cooperative relationship going on between the media, whom he used to make himself very famous. And the fame just kept getting more and more and more to the point of absurdity. And I would say more than half, even as much as two-thirds of the pure pagination of this autobiography consists of him, his reprinting of laudatory articles that were pouring out 3 to 6 a day in the mainstream media. And showing pictures of his bobbleheads produced in China, of the cupcake, Fauci cupcakes, of, you know, every Fauci kind of memorabilia you can understand, the baseball cards, how much they were selling for on Etsy. It's all in here. The ego doesn't, this is, I guess my point, Jesse, is that you can't explain this kind of behavior through ego and vanity alone, right? That's not good enough. There was more going on here, and it was a PR effort on his part to make himself untouchable, because he figured that at some point they would figure out that this virus, that the global pandemic, was caused by backroom machinations that he had been engaged in for the previous 2 years. And it was his nightmare that it would come out. But it, I mean, that the virus would even be discovered, right? So he didn't even want that. He knew that it escaped sometime August, September. But his concern was that maybe nobody would notice. You know, he was aware that the infection fatality rate was likely to be very low, that it was only a threat to the elderly and to the infirm. So his actual hope was that it would sort of come and go and nobody would notice. So in early January, he was warning about a coming flu pandemic. He hoped that was his first plan. Plan A was to talk about a bad season of flu and hope that he could sneak the COVID virus within that and nobody would notice. If you're not testing for something, you don't notice. But that became not possible by late January, when China, of all places, became the place that broadcasts this out to the world, with people dropping dead in streets and all this kind of propaganda, right? So now that became impossible. So now he had to go to plan B, which was to pretend as if this had leapt from some animal, pangolin, whatever, to humans, and that this is an example of growing amounts of spillovers because of global warming or whatever the thing was. So he commissioned a paper by some close associates that were on his payroll and told them what the conclusion of the paper was. We have Slack messages now where they were doubting the conclusions of that paper, but he pushed it out, gave them big grants after they cooperated with him. And that paper was published in Nature. And it's still there. It's never been withdrawn, ironically. So that was the beginning of kind of years of hell for the American people, for actually most people in the world, all but three countries in the world locked down according to Fauci's own instructions, but also for Fauci personally. He didn't sleep much because he was panicked about protecting his own reputation and covering up his personal culpability in this. You can cut me off at any time, but I just want to add something else here, because this is actually really important. Fauci never had the position of COVID czar. He was one of many members of the coronavirus task force. But because of his cooperative relationship with media, and because his the way he curated his image, and the fact that he's quite good on television, he basically took over all the messaging for the White House. This was despite the fact that he was not particularly interested in the science. He wasn't consulting with other medical experts or scientists or reading PubMed. He wasn't doing anything. He was looking at the same websites you and I were, Our World and Data, and that sort of thing. Otherwise, he spent nearly 100% of his time in a combination of media appearances and political machinations. But he was, in a sense, very powerful, because he was getting on the phone with all these political figures, whether it was Mayor de Blasio of New York Andrew Cuomo in New York, or the public health guys in California, or any other state with whom he had a relationship, urging more lockdowns, more stay-at-home orders, more panics, more masks, more plexiglass, more one-way grocery aisles, whatever the thing is. He would do this every day. There wasn't enough lockdowns for him. Everything was locked down all the time. But otherwise, he was paying no attention to the science because he basically didn't care. This tremendously frustrated the White House, the first Trump administration. They couldn't stand it and didn't even understand why this was happening because they had never put him in charge of anything. But Fauci knew that that the more he was popular with the public, that would give him more protection, and there was nothing the White House could do about it. And that's indeed what happened. As early as April 23rd, 2020, Trump brings Anthony Fauci and Deborah Birx into the Oval Office and started screaming at them with tremendous amounts of bad language and that sort of thing, that they destroyed the country, they destroyed his presidency, they destroyed the economy, that they betrayed him, that they're the enemies, that they're fakes, they're frauds, that he had been lied to. Just steam coming out of his ears in fury. So he completely, they had lost his confidence completely, but they also had Trump kind of trapped. And so they had to regroup.
Why?
I tell you why. Because they had set up a kind of game. The game was this. If infections were going up, we're doing badly. If infections, they call them cases, but they really were just presence of virus. That's another subject. But if cases were going up, that's bad. More lockdowns. If cases were going down, that's good. Then we can open up. That's the way they set up the game. And nobody really was in a position to dispute that sort of metric, that desideratum. And it became a problem. And they knew this would be a problem for the White House because this was a fast mutating, fast spreading virus with a very low infection fatality rate. It was always inevitable, even from February, that 100% of everybody on the whole planet Earth was going to get some level of exposure to this. But if they set up this little game with high cycle rate PCR tests, with all sorts of things, so they could kind of doling out tests, testing on even when it was utterly pointless, distribute more tests. Oh, what do you know? There's more cases. They could always make it look like everything was getting worse all the time. And the White House didn't really know what to do about that. They didn't have another way to message their way out of this. So by default, Fauci kept his high position all the way up into the elections, which were dominated by mail-in ballots that the CDC had recommended so that we could all stay away from the virus. So that this is all kind of, these are things I think you and I had suspected, but it's quite remarkable to see it all laid out in 3D and Technicolor for the world to see. Probably Fauci never wanted these diaries out to be in raw form, but they are out in raw form. And today, there are a lot of people extremely panicked about and worried about the consequences from them.
Well, I guess I want to focus on this part of it, the consequences. What can they possibly be now that he got that jerkwater pardon from the auto pen of Joe Biden? Of course, retroactive 10 years. So the guy basically has a get out of jail free card. Yeah, his reputation is crap and it should be. But I mean, this is the kind of thing, Jeffrey, that obviously if you want to preserve a country, people have to get locked in a cage for years because of this. But I'm not naive. I don't see that happening.
That's not going to happen. But what is really critical here, Jesse, and I think this is actually just as important. I do think it's important. The release of these Fauci diaries and other things like the Slack messages or the proximal origin paper and many other things, what they've done is prepare the ground for the COVID, for the coronavirus response policies to be utterly and completely discredited. Now, I know they've been discredited with you for a long time. I mean, for me, I've been screaming about this stuff since January 2020. But still, among the establishment, among the mainstream media, among mainstream public health, among all the journals and the professional associations and so on, and academia, Fauci is still considered to be a hero, and the shots are widely seen as having been the answer to the pandemic. And yes, mistakes were made, but we did the best we could with what we had. That remains the establishment line. And I promise you now, if you get an official history written about it, it will be something along those lines. What Fauci is, what the diary show, is that to satisfy his vanity and fear and attempts at deflection, he was willing to let the entire country go down the drain, to see global poverty skyrocket, to see hospitals nearly shut down entirely so that people missed diagnostics. I mean, there are basically millions and millions of people suffered and died. And also, he was willing to give a pass on shots that he knew were not safe. And I'm just now at that passage now. He was astonished that Moderna was ever put into the trials in the first place. I mean, like, he had very little confidence, and he knew they didn't stop the spread of the disease very early on. So he knew all of this stuff, but he pressed on, and it just shows a kind of a level of malevolence from a kind of a ruling class elite that I don't think most people are even now are prepared to believe could really exist.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is the exact part that honestly stood out to me more than anything else. Not the fights with Trump, not the anything else. And look, I already didn't need any help hating that little dwarf, and I'm sure you didn't either. But it seems so evil. I mean, it just seems so nakedly evil that we have all the video clips. They're all over online today that pretty much every single thing he said publicly to the American public was the opposite of what he knew to be true. It's like he's a sociopath.
Yeah, for sure. And what's also interesting is the way he's so, squirrely and avoiding any criticism. So, he routinely claimed that he wasn't responsible for any of the lockdowns, that he didn't call for the country to be locked down. Okay, so from his diaries, we know that's all he did from the very beginning. He kept it up for 2 years, more lockdowns, more panics, the more controls, more masking, more shots in arms, even after he knew that they were ineffective. This went on. So, yeah, the duplicity here is. It's pathological. And I talked to earlier today, because I've been really rattled by this, but I mean, Fauci's role in this has always been a bit mysterious to me, because Scott Ellis always said, wait, this guy didn't actually have any power. Where did he had power, but he didn't have power. Why is everybody paying attention to him? So now we know how the dynamic worked between him and the media. They basically had a wink, wink, nudge, nudge situation. They knew that he was doing his best to make sure that Trump would be driven from office. So he would tell them that. He would cooperate with them. He was very close to Jake Tapper over at CNN, but many, many of these reporters, they knew what was up. It was a big scheme, a big plot to get rid of Trump. That was part of it. Another part of the plot was to make good on Bill Gates' investments in vaccines, right? So there was a product they had to deliver, even though they knew it was not effective and probably not safe. They knew that going in. So all of this really happened. It was something like 5 years of lies. And let's, the other thing, Jesse, is like, keep in mind that, the economy has never really recovered from this thing. Labor participation still in the tank. We have something like 10 million fewer people working today in jobs in the U.S. than we had in 2019. The workers never really came back. Supply chains still remain broken. We experienced inflation somewhere between 30 and 40%, and sometimes much, much higher. So we lost half the purchasing power of the dollar. government debt exploded beyond which we'll never come back from. So this was what I've called a hinge of history. This COVID response changed the status of freedom and prosperity fundamentally, not to mention demoralizing the public, getting everybody addicted to SSRIs, shattering communities and families, leading to demographic upheaval. Millions were fired from their jobs because they wouldn't want to take the shots. So Fauci was the face and voice of the entire response. I don't think he was the decision maker. And even after reading the diaries, I don't even know who the decision maker really was. In fact, I don't even think Fauci does. Fauci didn't even really care. He was a marionette. He was a performer. He was an actor. He was and is an actor. That's his real talent. It's not science. It's certainly not medicine. It certainly wasn't pandemic response. So that's what it tells us. I mean, there's a kind of a level of fakery that we all endured for years. And we've now getting the curtain pulled back in ways that even for me, and I was prepared for anything, I find just utterly, utterly shocking.
No, it's wild to suspect all these things. And then to just, as you said, read them in Technicolor. It's Jeffrey.
It is. And there's, do you need to let me do it? I was just going to mention one other thing. There's so much in here, but there's this interesting passage. So I wondered how all this began, the lockdowns in particular. Nancy Messonnier of the CDC was the first one to brief the New York Times, Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal on the coming lockdowns. This would have been February 24th, 2020. And I wonder, and she is the sister of Rod Rosenstein, who was the man tasked with firing James Comey, thereby triggering a panic on the part of the deep state. What are we going to do? We got to get rid of this guy. Well, Rosenstein didn't like that role, talks to his sister. His sister talks to the press. The press gets on board. But what I had not known until these diaries was that her first point of contact on this was none other than Anthony Fauci. Very interesting.
Mm-mm.
Things like that.
Jeffrey.
So much.
You have a lot of reading still to do. We'll talk to you again soon. I appreciate you. Whew. It's something. You know, if I have to be grateful about something from that period of time, it was that period of time that led me to discovering chalk, natural herbal supplements from chalk. I'm not kidding. I found out about chalk because they were online loudly talking about lockdowns. What? Take your stupid mask off. Go outside. Get some exercise. And they were taking a beating from the establishment for these positions. And so we linked up, and they started telling me, hey, you should try this male vitality stack from Chalk. I think you're going to love how you feel. Man, 4 years, I think more now, I've been taking a male vitality stack every single morning. You want to change your life? Start some natural herbal supplements from Chalk. They have female vitality stacks, chocolate powder for the morning. CHOQ.com/JesseTV. We'll be back. All right, it's time to lighten the mood. And the shifting positions of Joe Biden just absolutely murdered me. Joe Biden is the biggest, most brazen liar in the history of American politics. And I know that they're all liars, right? So it's grading on a scale. Nobody ever did it like Joe Biden. For instance, Mays Moore put together this little montage of Joe Biden. Remember how he always talked about him? He was such a civil rights leader? Yeah, except he kept changing the names.
The men and women who educated me when we'd sit over in Reverend Wright's church as we were talking about desegregating the Rialto and the Queen movie theaters. Remember, Mouse, those days?
Got involved in desegregating movie theaters and helping, you may remember, Reverend Moyer in Delaware and Herman Holloway organize voter registration drives coming out of black churches on Sunday, figuring how we were going to move.
I'd go to 8 o'clock Mass, then I'd go to Reverend Herring's church where we'd meet in order to organize and figure where we were going to go whether we're going to desegregate the Rialto movie theater or what we were going
to
do.
No, I'm serious. It started a civil rights movement. I used to go to 7:30 Mass, then I'd go to 10 o'clock services. The reverend who was then running the church is now the bishop. She's a bishop. And I used to go to 7:30 Mass in my church, and then I would show up at Reverend Beeman's, now Bishop Beeman, church, AME church in Wilmington, get ready to go out and make the plans for what we're going to do.
I was not an activist. I was not out marching. I was not down in Selma. I was not anywhere else.
I miss him sometimes. I'll see you tomorrow. I would thank you for coming to my YouTube channel, but I know how brilliant it is, and I know you love it here. So subscribe and watch. We're going to start really ramping things up and putting some funny stuff, some interesting stuff out there, some collaborations. Either way, my YouTube channel is officially the place to be. So stick around.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.